Thelema Coast to Coast, Show 21, February 26, 2006. Thou wilt should be the whole of the law. Welcome to Thelema Coast to Coast. My name is John Crow, and I'm the host of the show. Before we get into the show, I want to remind all the listeners that there are a number of ways to contact the show. In show 20, I misspoke and gave the wrong address for the new MySpace website. Despite that, I've had over 110, actually, I guess exactly 118 people find the site and request to be friended on it. So thank you to those who have already friended on the site, and I welcome those other people listening who would want to be friended on the site to look up www.myspace.com/ThelemaCoastToCoast. Yes, it's the whole name, Thelema Coast to Coast, written off, and not the abbreviation that I said on the last show. Also, I want to remind everybody that the Thelema Coast to Coast phone number has changed. It is now 206-337-0888, and I want to strongly encourage people to call and leave messages. Remember, this is a audio program, and I love the feedback, and we'll get into that later in the show, that I get via email, MySpace, and other places. But I would also like to get audio feedback from people so that I can play it on the show. Again, another reminder is the email address is podcast@ThelemaCoastToCoast. The website is www.ThelemaCoastToCoast.com. And the mailing address is Thelema Coast to Coast, care of John Crow, P.O. Box 7045, Marietta, Georgia, M-A-R-I-E-T-T-A, Georgia, G-A. Zip code is 30065, and that's in the United States. It seems show 20 kind of took off. Now, all of the shows in the past have been very successful. Some of them have been downloaded over 2,000 times. Most of them are averaging around 1,400 to 1,800 times. But it seems show 20 really kind of exploded, and I want to thank everybody for the success of that. As of this recording, the show has been downloaded already in just 2 weeks over 1,250 times, and that includes 400 downloads in the first full day. So thanks to everybody for making this very, very successful, and I hope to continue to produce shows that you all like. In the last show, I played a CD from a group called Envy is Blind, and that was a CD provided by Latex Records. So I want to thank Latex, one of our sponsors, and when I say sponsors, they're not giving any money, but they are giving this music to be played on the podcast and these CDs to be given away. And since we are talking about giving CDs away, I want to name the new winner for the Envy is Blind CD, and that is John from Northwood, North Dakota. So congratulations to you, John, and I will be getting that CD out to you soon. The other one has been sent out, but I do want to apologize to the people who have sent postcards. I know I'm way overdue to get those stickers to you. I sincerely apologize, and we'll be getting those out shortly. There's probably almost a dozen here to send out. So, also, back to CDs, on today's show, we're going to be playing a song called Crucified Serpent by the group Asmodeus X, from their album Morning Star. And again, that was provided free by Latex Records, and Of course, anybody who wants to get this CD, feel free to email the podcast, podcast@thelimacoastacoast.com, and leave your address in the podcast email, and I will pick one random winner and give this CD away. Also, to those who have already entered before, your name has still stayed in the CD giveaway pile, so you do not need to resend your address. So, on to the feedback. As I said, show 20 kind of took off, and I received a tremendous amount of feedback, and so I thank you all very, very much for that. So I'm going to read about a dozen emails. I'm not going to read them all in their entirety. Some of them are lengthy, but I will read little snippets of each one and respond to them accordingly. So the first one is from Steve. He says, "Hello, I'm not a member of the OTO or any similar hermetic organization. I tend to keep myself outside of the community and am primarily interested more in theory than in practice. I, quote, keep an open mind, close quote. I wanted to tell you, however, that I love your podcast, and I hope you keep up the amazing work. I eagerly look forward to updated podcasts. Keep up the amazing work." So thank you very much, Steve. I appreciate the comment. The next is from a listener named Mandy. She titles this one, "Great Show. I just wanted to say that I love your show. Though I am not a Thelemite, I find this podcast to have such valuable interviews and information for just about anyone. My husband, Dio from Dio Shadow, parenthetically, an excellent, excellent podcast and one I highly recommend. Anyway, my husband turned me onto the show after his interview with you on one of his shows, and I'm pretty thankful for it. It is great to hear information that is not the typical, quote, pagan light talks. Your interviews and topics are more advanced, more serious, and more practical than many other shows. You do not suck up to those you interview, but instead challenge them and provide just a rich base of information. While this might not attract some, I think it is fantastic. Keep up the great work, Mandy." Well, thank you very much, Mandy. I appreciate it. And to Matt, I appreciate you introducing Mandy to the show. And also, I can't recommend your show enough, and I encourage everybody to listen to Dio Shadow. The next email is from Gunner. He says, 93, "Hey, John, I love the show. Thanks for putting so much great and entertaining information into your show. I thank you for all the hard work and putting it together and maintaining it." 93s. Thank you very much, Gunner. I appreciate that. And I appreciate your suggestion that was in your email for an upcoming show. I'll see what I can do about that. Similarly, here's an email from Tim Walker. He says, "John, do it the will should be the whole of the law. Thanks for another great podcast. Keith was contrary, as always. Being right affords him this luxury. And Bishop Greenfield's work is deserving of a wider audience. I can only hope that your Wiccan listeners will hold fast to the pagan ideals of truth and tolerance and not give you too much grief for exploring the documented Crowley-Gardner connection. Though we Thelemites often squabble about lineage, the wise know that the validity of a faith is proven by the actions of its members. Thanks again. Love is the law. Love under will. Tim." Also, Tim had a suggestion in there, too, so thanks, Tim, for that, and I'll see what I can do. Next one is from a listener named Palace. "Just finished listening to your interview with Bishop T. Allen Greenfield on the history of Wicca. I found it very stimulating and thought-provoking. This was my first time tuning in, and I'm glad I did. I look forward to hearing more of your podcast." So thank you for that feedback. I will also be forwarding these on to Keith and Bishop T. Allen Greenfield. The next one is from a listener named Asha. 93, "Love the podcast. Appreciate your effort in making them. I especially enjoy listening to the magical technical sessions, such as Lon Duquette's discussion on Enochiana, Richard Kaczynski's AC, and the Ouija, etc. I'd love to see more of these kinds of segments on the show. They're really useful, informative, also very practical. It's always interesting to explore other views on working these systems. Keep up the great work, 93. Thank you. I will see what I can do. I do talk to a lot of people about the practical aspects. One problem is that while there are a number of people who have somewhat worked with these systems, very few people could be considered experts or have a degree of knowledge in which coming on the podcast could significantly add or help others. So I'm always looking for advanced practitioners who have a lot to say and a lot of experience about a subject, and when I find them, that's when I have them on the show. So I will keep an eye out for other practitioners and see what I can do. The next one is from Joe. And he says, 93, I've been listening to the podcast for a few months now, finally getting caught up on all the episodes. At first, I thought Keith 418 was an over-opinionated bore, then slowly realized how crucial his line of discussion and criticism is. Though not an OTO member or planning to be, the content of all the discussions, from the issues of transparency in the organization to the issue of lack of objective goals, apply to many things, not just on a nonprofit order type level, but in many iterations of issues that inherently live in business. I found a direct parallel between his comments about the issues within the OTO and my own struggles within my business. I think that this parallel exemplifies the validity and the crucialness of his comments and the intriguing discussions you two have on the podcast. After hearing the most recent podcast covering the OTO / Crowley connection to Wicca tradition, I realize that there are many organizations, quasi-religions, for the lack of better terms, that roots lie either in the OTO or Crowleyana. For instance, the association of Jack Parsons and L. Ron Hubbard, and possible thelemic overtones in Scientology. Thanks and keep the podcast coming. Not a show goes by where something didn't pique my interest or broaden my understanding of the occult. 93, 93, 93, Joe. Thank you very much for that, Joe. I appreciate it, and I also appreciate your suggestion in there. The next one is from Bruce. 93, John. Just a note to let you know that I thoroughly enjoyed your most recent podcast, number 20. The interviews with Keith 418 and Tao Allen were quite informative and thought-provoking. Do keep up the good work. 93, Bruce. Thanks for that. And this is an feedback that came through the MySpace website. It's from Matt in Osaka, Japan. It was just another search over the internet, Google, looking for stuff on Thelema Crowley OTO, as I'm interested in joining an OTO community in the near future after a location move. When I came across Thelema Coast to Coast, I just downloaded all your episodes and have been listening to them in chronological order. So far, I've heard the first three episodes, and I really am enjoying what you're doing. I like the fact that you've chosen to have an interview-heavy show. It's enjoyable to hear this feedback from the Thelema / OTO community. Also, I don't know any of these names, so each show is a nice surprise. And I'm hearing music I would have never heard otherwise. Being a musician and follower of Crowley myself, I like hearing how others are inspired by Crowley and Thelema. Anyways, I just wanted to say that I enjoy your show and wish you the best in future episodes. I look forward to listening to the rest of your episodes. Thank you very much, Matt. I appreciate the feedback, and I hope you enjoy the subsequent 18 or so shows that are remaining for you to hear. MySpace also allows people to leave individual or small comments that can be seen, and I've gotten them from, again, Matt has left another one there. Someone by the name MIB, Hyperborean, Fran Fryel, Carlos, Kelpius. Thanks to all of you for the positive comments that you left on the MySpace page. And the last email I'm going to read is from a listener named actually, he doesn't give his full name, but he gives his magical name, Freighter Horace Lux. And he says, "Care Freighter, do what thou wilt should be the whole of the law. In a recent TCTC podcast, I believe number 20, you called the Scale the Fence LJ campaign foolish. Can you explain how you came to judge this campaign in this way, and how condemning those who pay dues and make it known as an example to others supports your values and long-term directions you desire for the order? Could you also explain what you would like to see instead of such campaigns? Love is the law, love under will. Fraternally yours, Freighter Horace Lux." I did. In the interview with Keith 418, the Scale of the Fence campaign was mentioned, and I did call it foolish. The reason I called it foolish is I think while the attitude or intentions behind it may be valid, I think the way that it's executed is actually pretty poor. First of all, Scale the Fence is, for those who don't know, is a program instituted by some OTO members who wanted to indicate that they were supporters of the local bodies that they belong to and were trying to get others to do so. And they had a number of graphics that you could post on your live journal, which is a blog, or you could put on your website and so forth. The reason I think Scale the Fence is, quote, foolish is because it first depends upon peer pressure. Peer pressure, to me, is a really bad form of coercion. And peer pressure forces people to do things that they do not necessarily agree or would not have done otherwise if it weren't for the coercive effects of somebody else. And this, to me, does not seem very thelemic. So I'm kind of anti any coercive attitudes whatsoever. And if people don't want to support their local bodies, I don't think they should be peer pressured into doing so. If they do want to support their local bodies, I think they should. Second, I think the Scale the Fence campaign is sending the wrong message. I think people should support their local bodies, but I don't think that it is a badge of honor to say that you are doing what is right. People should not get credit for doing the basic minimum, like showing up to work on time. You don't wear a badge that says, I showed up to work on time. You don't wear a badge that said, I paid my taxes. You don't get credit for doing the minimum things that you should do. If people are supporting their local bodies, then that is what they should do minimally. So I don't see why people should get bragging rights and put little graphics on their web pages to make it look like they're doing something great when actually what they're doing is something minimum. So these are the few reasons why I think the Scale the Fence campaign is kind of foolish. Now, you asked what should be done instead of the Scale the Fence campaign. Well, I think people should pay local dues to their body if they're active. I also think U.S. Grand Lodge, who has made the dues mandatory for national and mandatory for an international, should also make local dues mandatory. This is what other groups like the Masons and, I mean, even non-fraternal organizations do. I don't see any reason why U.S. Grand Lodge shouldn't do so. U.S. Grand Lodge and the officers of U.S. Grand Lodge often say that they do all of they can to support the local bodies. However, that is simply not true by the sheer fact that they have not made local dues mandatory. They have set up unfunded mandates, such as getting a local body space, performing certain amounts of initiations and the Gnostic Mass to receive certain levels of designation of Oasis and Lodge. And all of these things cost money and require resources. And yet U.S. Grand Lodge will not mandate that its membership go and pay for that. Recently, they have instituted a small rule that will help prevent people who do not support the local body from taking initiation locally. But this is very little, and there are some caveats and provisions in there that allow people to get beyond this rule. If Grand Lodge was really interested in supporting local bodies, they would make the local dues mandatory, and they would also require local dues paying to be in good report with the OTO. These are two things they have not done, and as far as I'm aware, they're not going to do. You just have to look at something like the Masons to see somebody who actually does that and the benefits that that generates. After all, Masons have buildings and places to meet and places to do their initiations, and the OTO bodies even struggle to pay rent to do so. So I think there is a big contrast right there. So I hope that answers your question, Freighter Horace Lux. And I have one more feedback. This is an audio feedback, something that made me smile and kind of laugh. So here it is.
Nice to meet John. This is Nicole. I've been listening to the podcast for quite a while, and I just want to say that every time I hear it, your voice gets sexier and sexier and sexier. Anyway, love is the law. Love underwear. Bye-bye.
Thank you very much, Nicole. That audio feedback made me laugh, and perhaps it is the fact that I'm still getting over a cold that has made my voice sound a little different. So you describing it as sexy was quite flattering. Thank you very much. Anyway, I want to get into the meat of the program, you might say. The first thing I want to explain is this program is going to be a little different than those in the past. Most of the shows before have had two or three long interviews with a variety of guests about certain subjects. This show is going to be much longer. I'm thinking it's probably going to be around an hour and a half to an hour 45 minutes. And on it, I'm going to be presenting small interviews anywhere between 5, 6, 7, up to 15 or 16 minute interviews with a number of people about a variety of products and events that are going on in the spring or are available now. The reason I'm doing this goes back to something I explained in a previous podcast. This podcast is about exhibiting what is going on in the Thelemic culture. And I define Thelemic culture as what self-defined Thelemites are doing and manifesting in the name of their spirituality, in this case, Thelema. So on today's show, I have an interview with a number of event coordinators who are doing conferences, symposiums, festivals, and things like that. I also have an interview with Jerry Cornelius about his biography of Grady Lewis McMurtry. And then also recently, The Rite of Luna, a rock opera version, has been recorded and released on DVD, and I talked to the director of that. So there are going to be six different small interviews with people about the various things that are making up, you know, the quote, Thelemic culture, or part of it. And so I wanted to highlight those. And then also, I do have a response from Keith418, because a listener sent in an email specifically asking him some questions. So Keith and I spoke, and he has some response to the questions given by that listener. So let me start with Keith's response, and then we will get into the four events that are being discussed on the show, and then we will end with the last two interviews about the Rite of Luna CD and DVD, and then the biography of Grady Lewis McMurtry, and then the ending the show with the song Crucified Serpent by Asmodeus X. So here's Keith.
Keith, welcome back to the podcast.
Oh, thanks for having me, John. 93.
And on podcast 20, we talked about local dues, and I asked a lot of people to give feedback, and the feedback has been tremendous. One feedback message in particular I wanted to address with you, because the writer, a gentleman named Lon from the San Francisco Bay Area, asks a number of questions. So I'm going to read a little bit of his email to you and get some responses. He says, 93, I was wondering, do you or Keith 418 have anything good to say about the order? While I consider myself a Thelemite, I'm not a member of the OTO or any similar order. The main reason is this: whenever I talk to my friends who are in or were in the order, what I hear are long stories about what's wrong with the order, internal political scandals, story about how sleazy most of the members are, complaints about how little is done or how poorly things are organized, you know, the kind of thing I'm talking about. When I ask about what is good, the initiations are nice and the rites are elusive. So he goes on, and he asks, but is there anything that you have good to say about the order?
Well, I think this is an interesting question, and I think that, you know, you and I really tend to get into very critical sorts of discussions on the podcast and in other places, and we're doing that in part because we're trying to balance the sort of atmosphere of happy talk that I think is engendered by the culture of fear and this concern people have about saying anything critical. And you and I, on the other hand, feel like we sometimes need to balance that and say the critical things that, officer once said to my wife, you know, Keith says the things we think in the back of our head but are afraid to say. You know, you and I want to say those things, get them out in the open and help the organization by not being afraid of our own points of view and then not being afraid to be critical. So that being said, I think, you know, people have to realize that we're trying to present the other side to the a lot of the happy talk that we sort of see in the OTO. Now, do we think that there's positive things in the order? Do I think there are positive things in the order? Of course there are. If we didn't care about this so much, why would we be spending any time talking about it at all? That's the first thing people, I think, need to look at. And one of the things that I think is interesting is that many people are actually drawn to the order by looking at how seriously and how much it means to people when they argue or fight about it. I was first attracted to the OTO when I was in college, one of Marcelo Motta's versions of the Equinox that, you know, not only showed me that people were interested in Aleister Crowley, but they were interested enough to fight about it. You know, Motta would publish page after page after page of rants against various individuals, and I said, wow, you know, there are people out there that are into Crowley, and they're all fighting with each other. This is great. And I was attracted to it in part because I saw that it generated that kind of concern. So I think that's significant, and I've seen this happen with other people who, you know, watch people fighting and then decide to join the order because it's obviously something important enough to cause people to fight about. You know, personally, I find many things that are positive with the OTO. For one thing, I meet wonderful people in it. There are amazingly great people in the OTO, people that I never would have met any other way. I remember one experience. I was at the Elitesor Merrill's house, and a guy from Germany was there who I'd never laid eyes on before, never talked to, never written to. He walked into the room, and we immediately knew that we had all this stuff in common and could sit down and have a wonderful conversation, and that never happens in other circumstances. It's a very rare experience. And it happens all the time in the OTO. I traveled all over the country. I've met people all over the country in the OTO. I've met many friends, you know, people that I'm very close to, that I talk to every day on the phone or IM or email back and forth. And I wouldn't pass that up for the world. The other thing that I think is important and that people need to really look at is I was in a conversation with a friend a few days ago who asked me about the Gnostic Church. And in the conversation, I realized I could talk for an hour about the Gnostic Church, and we would only skim the very tippy top of the iceberg. So just one little thing, one aspect, is so fascinating, and there's so much material and so many things to think about and work on and look at and study and ponder and debate and investigate. And that's just one aspect of the OTO.
Well, something that I also want to point out that I find meaningful is that I've got this group of people that I have a lot in common, kind of what you're saying, and that we can actually work together on goals. I mean, we talk about the lack of national goals, but that doesn't stop local and regional goals from happening. And I really enjoy working with the people to make these things happen, whether it's doing some kind of theatrical production or the initiations or some other kind of symposium or conference or classes. I get to work with like-minded people, and we get to work towards the fulfillment of doing our magical will and doing magic, whether it's ritual or lectures or any of that kind
right.
of stuff.
I think both you and I have seen the positive aspects of the OTO are so amazing that we're disappointed that work isn't being done to maximize them. I mean, if you get the hint that the OTO could be this wonderful thing, then you're frustrated when everybody acts like it's something that shouldn't be taken that seriously, or that you can't make too many demands on it or the other people in it, or that you can't judge people for flaking or for being stupid. Then you get really angry because you're like, look, the potential of this thing is enormous. Why are you screwing it up? And that's, I think, really one of the reasons why we're as critical as we are. We've seen the potential. We know it can be great. We've seen the potential in the books and with other people and within ourselves. And we're looking at this saying, we want the OTO to maximize that potential, to bring that potential into manifestation. And the leaders and many of the people in the order don't really seem that keen on that process. And that's what I think makes us frustrated. If we didn't love it, we wouldn't want to see it work better.
Well, in the email, it goes on, and it actually does talk a little bit about the dues issue. He goes on saying, on that subject, I stopped halfway through podcast number 20 to write this. Keith's comments on the issue of dues gave me another bullet point for the long list of what I've heard's wrong with the OTO. However, I want to take exception to the couple of times he seems to be equating payment of dues with being serious about the OTO. There may be many, as he styles it, freeloaders, but is it not possible that they are also people who contribute time and energy? Are they to be excluded if they lack funds? So do you have an answer to that?
Well, I think a lot of folks have addressed this in other forums, and I think that we're not trying to exclude hardworking people who can't pay. That's not what we're about, and that's not what we want. But people who make this sort of worry or cause this kind of and have this kind of anxiety about the dues obviously really haven't studied what Crowley himself had to say about it. I mean, he basically said people needed to give money, that they needed to make the dues a number one priority, and that if someone is weak and not really functioning well in society, you don't help them any by giving them charity and sort of nursing them along in their weakness. You help them by making sure that they're strong and not enabling them. And every time I hear this, I think to myself, should everyone in the OTO who doesn't have any money be enabled by everybody else? Is that really what it's about? And I think that people like this need to look at, if they're concerned about people who can't pay, they are the ones who need to come up with a way to make sure that the people who are participating who don't have any money aren't just freeloading and telling us this. So it's a complex question, and we're going to have to see it shake out. But I think this is a red herring. I mean, I don't think the OTO currently is asking very much in dues from anybody, not even its highest initiates. And, people keep saying to me, I pay more in my gym membership than I do for the OTO.
Right.
And if the OTO matters that much to people, they'll find a way to get the money for it. I mean, this is something that we need to really be serious about. And this constant concern about people who don't have any money. I mean, look what Crowley had to say himself about that. He was not, saying that the OTO was supposed to be giving charity to one and all. That was not his attitude.
No. There's a brother in the local body who works at a fast food restaurant and does not make a lot of money. And the dues at the Atlanta local body is around $40. And he consistently pays dues every month. So, I mean, if he can do it working at a fast food restaurant, I can't really see how other people can't do it, especially when the dues are a lot less, where, as far as I'm aware, most of the dues are around $20 a month.
Right. They're absurdly low. Even under the best of circumstances, they're absurdly low. And, the folks that complain about this, I just think are stoned. I mean, I just think they're living in la-la land. And it's to the extent that we can see that people really haven't made the OTO a priority in a lot of ways because they're not being challenged to. The leadership doesn't want to come out and challenge people to make the OTO the priority that it needs to be if it's going to look like the OTO Crowley described in the Blue Equinox. And someone once said, ambition that does not reckon with sacrifice results in neurosis. So if your ambition is to create an OTO that looks like the one in the Blue Equinox, you have to reckon with the sacrifices that ambition is going to require, or you're going to be neurotic and stupid. And as long as the OTO doesn't look at what sacrifices it's going to need to make, it'll be neurotic and stupid.
Well, I also want to make sure that people are aware that dues are not the only solution. Local dues are not a silver bullet that is going to solve the OTO problem.
Oh, you're 100% right about that.
I mean,
people who think that it's going to be are deluded.
If you read the Ian Cohn stuff, he is quite clear that a sectarian organization not only charges money, but they also have a high load of work, participation, and knowledge that the members have to acquire to be part of the sectarian environment.
Oh, he's absolutely right about that, and I think people need to read the Ian Cohn to get away from the idea that mandatory local dues are going to solve the OTO's problem, because it's not. And there are problems with rich people sort of buying their way out of having to be really engaged in the organization.
Right. That you actually find that in churches.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, that's a big problem with the churches like the Anglican, the Episcopalian, Methodist.
Right.
You got all of these wealthy people who give lots of money to the church but then never show up, never participate.
Well, we also have that problem in the OTO, too, on a certain level as well. I mean, that's not a problem that we don't have. And if you look at the OTO, in a lot of ways, it has all of the worst problems of a sect and none of the benefits, and all of the worst problems of a church and none of the benefits of that really either. It's the worst of both worlds and the best of neither.
Yeah.
Which I think is a significant situation.
Well, on this show, I'm doing a bunch of little segments, about 10 to 15 minutes each. So I just wanted to get your response to this email, and so maybe on the next show we can have a little longer segment and talk about another subject.
That would be great.
All right. Thanks, Keith. 93.
No problem. 93 John.
Now I'm going to get into the four events. The first one is the 10th anniversary celebration of U.S. Grand Lodge that is being presented by LVX Oasis in Los Angeles. Then I'm going to be speaking with Joseph Thebes, who is the lodge master of Sekhmet Mot Lodge in Portland, Oregon. They are presenting a Thelemic symposium. Then I'm going to be speaking with Kayla Block. She is the on-site coordinator of the OTO's Women Thelemic Symposium, and that is a conference that will be presented this summer in Las Vegas. After that, I'm going to be talking with Anita Kraft, who is one of the organizers of the Babylon Rising Festival. So I'm going to be doing all four of those in order, and I'm not going to be breaking in between. And then after the Babylon Rising, I'll be going into the Rite of Luna interview, talking about the production of the Rite of Luna that was done as a rock opera, and that there is a CD and DVD available of that. And then after that, I'm going to be speaking with Jerry Cornelius about his biography of Grady Lewis McMurtry. So again, I'm going to be presenting all of these in order, and so I won't be talking in between to save a little time. So here we go.
We have with us Cindy Weinstein, the Oasis Master of LVX Oasis in Los Angeles, California. 93, Cindy.
93, John.
On this show, I've been trying to spotlight a lot of the various events that contribute to Thelemic culture. And I know LVX Oasis is doing an event in March. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. On March 25th, we will be doing a celebration of the 10th anniversary of U.S. Grand Lodge, which was chartered in the spring equinox of 1996.
And that's a Saturday, right?
It's a Saturday night. It starts at 6 o'clock.
So what is the Oasis doing to celebrate?
The main thing that we've done is we've put together a production of Aleister Crowley's mystery play, The Ship. And we've been fortunate enough to be working with some rather experienced musicians. So we will be featuring a brand new a cappella chorus with an original score that was written by our brother Oliver Alteen.
Oh, wow. That's fantastic.
Yeah, we're very excited about that.
And is it just the presentation of the ship that is part of the celebration, or is there more to it?
No, we're going to be opening at 6 o'clock with a cocktail hour, and at 7 we'll be serving a catered buffet dinner.
Oh, okay.
The play will be at 8:30.
And the dinner, is that taking into account various eating habits? I know I'm a vegetarian, so I always tend to ask, does that have vegetarian options?
We always make sure there are vegetarian options.
Well, great. How much is it to attend the dinner and the play?
It's $35 for the play and the dinner. And this is actually being sponsored in part by a local business here called Celtic Jackalope, who has put up a generous donation to help us out with this. This business does a lot of pirate stuff, a lot of art things, Baphomet pendants and T-shirts, and we'll also be having some OTO commemorative Laman shirts and gear there as well, and he will be on site and vending some of his wares.
Oh, very cool.
Event.
Very cool. Now, is this a casual event, or is this a formal? What is the dress code?
We haven't specified a dress code. I'm hoping that people don't come in ripped up jeans and shorts and T-shirts, although if that was their will, I suppose that would be fine. But the event is taking place at the Ionic Composite Lodge in Los Angeles, which is a pretty nice place. So I'm assuming that people will dress accordingly.
Great. Now, if somebody wanted to reserve a spot, do they email you, or how should they do that?
They can go to the LVX website, where there is a reservations link to a PayPal site, and the LVX website is at www.lvx-oto.org.
Mm-hmm.
And so they can either pay through the PayPal site, which will immediately hold their reservations, or they can mail a check to the Oasis. The address is, again, on that site. Or if they're local, they can pay us in person and make the reservation that way.
Is there a deadline for sending in the payment?
The deadline for reservations is March 7th. The other thing that people might want to know is that the event is initiates and invited guests. So if you are an initiate, you're of course welcome. If you're not an initiate and have a special affiliation with the OTO, are a partner of an OTO initiate, friend of the family, so to speak, please let us know. We're happy to have guests so long as you make yourself known to us.
Okay. Is there anything else the Oasis is doing commemoratively?
We'll be publishing a commemorative program that goes with this, and the program will be for the ship primarily. However, in there, we're reserving two pages that have about 20 spaces for initiates and well-wishers to send in their congratulations. And we can take that pretty much in any form, a lot like high school yearbooks are done. If you want to just write it out and scan it, if you want to send us what you would like to have it say and let us lay it out for a $10 donation, we'll put your congratulations in the book for you. And if you're not able to attend and request it, we'd be happy to send you a program so that you can see your congratulations. We're also taking some advertising in there from local businesses or online from MIC, magical-oriented businesses.
Well, is there anything else that the listeners should be aware of?
If you're not able to attend but are local and would like to just see the ship, on the previous Sunday, March 19th, we'll be doing a completely public presentation of the ship at 7 o'clock at the Actors Playpen, which is on Gardner, right off of Sunset Boulevard. And that production is a $10 ticket. There's a reservation line where you can email shipreservations@lvx-oto.org, and you will reserve your space, pay at the door, and get to see the ship even if you can't attend the function.
Oh, is there a total limit or a maximum number of attendees for the dinner and the ship?
For the dinner and the ship, we're drawing the line at about 75,
okay,
which I think is going to be a pretty safe limit. The public presentation is Black Box Theater that seats 50. So right now we have one production booked, and we may be adding a matinee if we get enough reservations in.
Well, thank you very much for being on the show. I'm really excited to hear what LVX is doing and that U.S. Grand Lodge is turning a decade old. And so I wanted to make sure everybody knew that this was happening, and if they had the opportunity to attend, that they could. So thanks for being on the show.
Thank you so much for having me, John. I appreciate it.
All right. Talk to you later. 93.
Okay. 93.
We have on the phone with us Joseph Thebus, the Lodge Master of Sekhet Mot Lodge in Portland, Oregon. Welcome to the show, Joe. 93.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me. Do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law.
I asked you to be on the show because your lodge is putting on the 5th annual Thelemic Symposium. Can you tell us what the Thelemic Symposium is?
Sure, John. Thelemic Symposium is an annual panel discussion where we have three Thelemites who have been Thelemites for a long time sharing their perspective on Thelema. And it's an opportunity for initiates of OTO and the public to get a glimpse of Thelema through the eyes of people who have been practicing Thelema for a long time.
Now, when you say a glimpse through their eyes, is this a speech or a lecture, or is it a QA? How is the format of the symposium?
Well, the format basically works like this. Each panelist will introduce themselves for about 10 minutes by giving biographical information. After that, they will answer three questions, which they've had time to prepare answers for about 5 minutes each. And those questions are on our website, but I will go ahead and tell you what they are. It's three questions. The first one is, what do you think initiation is? The second one, what major differences have you found comparing your present perspective on Thelema to when you first approached the work? And the third question is, how do you personally distinguish between syncretism and the smorgasbord approach in Thelema? And these three questions are obviously pretty open-ended, broad questions, and they only have about 5 minutes to answer them. So, as the poet said, or words to this effect, brevity is the soul of wit. So they're going to have to really distill their thoughts on these. So that's the second section. And then finally, we follow that up with a question and answer from the audience, where they'll just be answering off the cuff. And then as the symposium ends, there will be a reception where people can talk more informally about the ideas that were brought up during symposium.
Now, the symposium is 2 days. Is that the discussion on the first or the second day?
That is on the first day. And actually, symposium proper is just a 1 day. But we do have, the next day, we have the Gnostic Mass performance, which will be performed this year by the three panelists. We have Doug and Karen James, who will then priest and priestess, and Sora Sulis and Lisa Faulkner will be the deacon.
Now, is this a fundraiser, or is this what kind of event is this for the lodge?
Well, it was not originally conceived of as a fundraiser so much as an opportunity for our local initiates to get exposure to people who've been Thelemites for a lot of years. However, as it turns out, it has become a fairly successful fundraiser for us, and we actually have the last 2 years, and we'll again have this year, about 18 students from the University of Montana attending as part of a sociology class on new religions. So it's become a little bit of an outreach vehicle as well.
Great. Since this is a recorded program, obviously a lot of listeners would love to hear what the panelists have to say. Is the symposium recorded, either audio or videotaped?
Actually, no. And we've certainly had requests in the past for recording to occur and for transcription to occur. But I feel, and I think a lot of the folks locally feel, that we have really a lot of opportunities to tune into Thelemic ideas and discussions through mediated channels. And, you know, for example, we have Yahoo groups, we have LiveJournal, we have this podcast, and these are all great venues for discussion and ideas. However, outside of the ritual temple and the occasional informal party, we have very few opportunities to have unmediated, or I should say immediate, interactions with people. And what I've found, you know, a lot of the panelists that we've had in the past have not been necessarily experienced in public speaking. And so having that measure of immediacy sort of sets the presenters at ease a little bit, and I think that it encourages an environment where people can really feel comfortable. And as I said, the whole purpose of symposium is for people to get a glimpse of Thelema through the eyes of these folks, and so I think it's important that there be a level of almost intimacy. And so we try to minimize the audience-performer dynamic as much as possible. And while certainly I would love it if people from all over the country and England could tune into this, I'm afraid that to do so would subvert some of the purposes of a symposium.
Okay. So if people are interested in this, they really need to make arrangements to attend in person.
That's right.
If somebody wanted more information on this, where could they go to get that?
They can go to our website, It's sekhetmat.com. That's sekhetmat.com. And you just click on events, and you'll see a little banner that says the Linux Symposium 5. You can click on that.
And what are the costs for attending?
The cost is $35 if you're not a member of Sekhetmat Lodge, and $20 if you are a member.
Is that something that can be paid at the door, or do tickets need to be purchased ahead of time?
You could pay it at the door. However, I would recommend purchasing it ahead of time. We've sold out the last 2 years, and I expect we will again this year.
Is there anything else that people should know?
Well, I guess, you know, I don't want to read the bios here, but I would encourage people to look at the biographical information about the panelists online and to look at the websites for previous years. We have those all up on our site in the special events area, and you can look at the panelists we've had in previous years, and maybe if folks who are listening to your show can't make it this year because it is coming right up, maybe they would be interested in making plans for next year. We always have it in spring, usually a week or two off of the equinox.
Great. All right. And if people have any questions, they can email you directly through the website?
That's right.
Wonderful. Well, Joseph, thank you very much for being on the podcast. I'm really excited about the success of the symposium, and I hope you sell out again this year.
Great. Thanks very much, John.
93. We have on the phone Kayla Block, the on-site coordinator of the OTO Women's Symposium. Welcome to the podcast, Kayla.
Good morning, John.
93. To begin with, can you tell us what was the reason that the Women's Symposium was created?
About 2 years ago, we were having a little priestess gathering out in California. It was just kind of a little casual thing. And we were realizing how much we really enjoyed each other's company and how much we really liked being around women's space and how within the OTO we don't really get enough of that. And we started making jokes about having a women's conference, and the jokes started to become more serious as we realized that we really wanted to create something that was more focused on the feminine in Salima. And out of that joke, at the last Noticon meeting, I started talking with some people and found that there was a lot of enthusiasm for it on a wider scale, and we started to put this conference together. Also, in addition, I had noticed that most of the speakers at various Noticon conferences, the majority had been men, and I wanted to create a space where the emphasis was on Thelemic women. And then lastly, I also wanted to be able to create something where young women coming into the order were able to see women in strong leadership positions within the OTO.
Great.
So that was kind of the genesis of it.
Excellent. So is this a conference only for women?
No, actually, we gave that a lot of thought and kind of went back and forth on it, and there are some really excellent arguments, both for and against, but we decided to make the conference open to women and allow the speakers, the individual speakers, to choose whether they wanted a single-sex event or to allow anybody to come. And in fact, as it turns out, we only have one presenter who's asked for a women-only presentation.
So men can attend.
Correct.
And men can...
And in fact, are most welcome.
Okay. And men can attend all but one of the speakers. Are all the speakers women?
Yes. That was something that was important in the planning of this, was we wanted all primary presenters to be women.
So at this time, how many speakers do you have planned?
We will have 12 speakers. The event will be double-tracked, so at any given time there will be two different events going on.
Okay, and what are the days of the event?
The event starts on July 29th of 2006 and ends on July 30th of 2006.
And what's the website that has the information about this?
Website is Noticon, notocon.org/OTOS 2006.
Great. Now, what are the costs of somebody wanting to attend?
The conference is $130 per person, and that includes breakfast, lunch, mid-morning snack, and mid-afternoon snack. The only thing not included is dinner and the actual accommodations. The accommodations are $99 per night, and it's the special conference rate.
And where is this conference taking place? We haven't said that yet.
It will be at the Gold Coast Casino in Las Vegas, Nevada.
Oh, excellent.
And that's right across the street from the Palms, which is a casino that a lot more people are familiar with.
Right, right. Okay. So the conference is in Las Vegas. It's about $100 a night, excuse me, and it's about $130 to attend. And that,
correct,
none of that includes any of the gambling money, which I'm sure people are prone to lose.
That is correct. Nor money for the shows or all the other kind of late-night entertainment or the fancy expensive restaurants that are around town,
yes,
let alone all the gambling money you can go lose.
Yeah, Las Vegas certainly has a number of distractions, you might say, that can take one's money quite quickly.
And that's one reason why we don't have anything scheduled in the evenings. People can go play.
Well, that's great.
Yeah.
So is the whole schedule for the conference online at this point?
No. The schedule will be going up within the next week or two, and the presentations and speakers will be going up within the next couple of days. It's going to take a little bit more time to get the schedule set.
Okay. And is there a maximum number of attendees?
No, there's not. Because we decided to double track it, we can accommodate quite a larger group than if we had just single tracked it.
Okay.
I should also mention, John, that in order to attend the conference, one does need to be a member of Ordo Templi Orientis.
Any minimum degree?
No.
Okay, so Minervals and up are welcome, but they do have
That's
to be
correct.
An initiate.
Correct.
Okay. Is there anything else that people should be aware of?
One of the things that's been pretty interesting about the proposals that we've received, we did not set a theme because we wanted to leave it open to see what might come in since this hadn't really been done before. The last women's conference was probably about a decade ago and really was operating under a different set of assumptions and it was a really an entirely different sort of event. So when proposals started coming in, much to my surprise and honestly my delight, we have a lot of presentations that are very body focused and very sexually focused. Not meaning that we're having, you know, orgies over at the Gold Coast for presentations, but lots of good, juicy, sexy, you know, Babylon kind of a vibe to it, and I'm really excited about that.
Excellent.
Yeah.
All right. Well, so that's what people can expect. So they need to. Is there a deadline for registration?
There is a deadline. I don't know what it is.
So people should just go to the website to check that out.
People should go to the website for further information.
Okay, sounds good.
And the deadline will be announced in Agape and in on the otlusa.org website.
Okay, sounds good. Well, thanks for being on the podcast and making the announcement about this. I'm sure many of the listeners will be very interested in attending.
That sounds great.
And is this planned to be an annual or a biannual thing or something like that?
I'm hoping that someone else will pick up the ball in another 2 years. I'm figuring on the off-Noticon years.
Okay.
Might be a nice event to have happen. But that's really going to be up to whether someone else wants to pick the torch up.
Okay. Sounds great. Well, thanks again, 93.
Thank you, John, 93.
We have with us Anita Kraft, Bishop of the OTO, and one of the organizers of the Babylon Rising Festival. Are you there, Anita?
Yes.
Welcome to the podcast, 93.
93, John.
So your group decided to create a festival. What was the reason behind the festival creation?
Well, it started, there were four of us
having dinner one night, and we were talking about Lon Duquette, and I started talking about bringing Lon back in here again because none of them had met him. And he's so funny and such a great speaker, and, you know, you've had him on. He's a wealth of wisdom and information about magic. And they got excited, and next, somebody in the group, and I don't know who, said who, oh, we should, you know, bring him in for a festival. And next thing I know, we were planning this festival, a Thelemic festival. And from there, it grew to a pan-Thelemic festival because everybody in the organizing group, unlike me, is not in the OTO. So it just kind of went from there. We started listing off names. I listed off names of people I knew that I could contact that I thought might be interested, and it just kind of exploded.
So when is the festival?
The festival is in June. It's June 15th through the 18th, Thursday through noon on Sunday, at a place called Our Haven in French Lick, Indiana.
In Indiana. Where in Indiana is that? What is it near?
French Lick is about an hour outside of Louisville, Kentucky. It's in southern Indiana.
Okay, southern Indiana. Who's going to be speaking there? I assume Lon Duquette, since you mentioned his name?
Lon is coming. Richard Kaczynski is going to be there. We have Sora Nima. I don't know if you're familiar with her or not. She wrote Mott Magic.
Uh-huh.
And she's out of Cincinnati, I believe. And then we have a man named Marty Laubach, who has lectured and done a lot of writing on magic. Michael Manor, a group called Stinky Beetle, who are a fire group who will man the fire, and they do a lot of fire stuff.
Now, when you say fire stuff, like fire spinning or breathing?
How do I describe it? They're a performance group and fire tending, and they've been at Starwood, Elf Fest, other pagan festivals, and they do fire shows as well as tend the fire the whole time they're there.
Mm-hmm.
It's very cool. You can see a little bit of their work on the website.
And now, are you also going to be doing other things like rituals, the Gnostic Mass, or...?
Yeah, actually, Thursday night, Om Ha from Chicago, OTO Body from Chicago, is going to do our opening ritual. And then Friday night will be a Gnostic Mass. And Saturday night is our big ritual, and it's called the Feast of the Beast.
And what is that?
I don't want to give a whole lot of away, but it's basically, it'll start with Lon Duquette playing I Was and proclaiming the law, and then there's a whole ritual around the beast and Babylon and the, you know, various entities within the Thelemic pantheon, however you want to say it, together. And it's really kind of to set the stage for a night of fun and partying and revelry, and it's really just kind of to launch that, but we're calling it the Feast of the Beast.
Okay. Now, when I see on your website, which to give the people the web address to get more information is babylonrising.org, B-A-B-A-L-O-N, rising.org. On the website, it says the pre-register date is April 15th.
Yes.
How much is the event?
If you register by April 15th, it's $65 for the entire weekend. If you after April 15th, it goes to $80, and then at the gate, it's $93.
And what is included for the registration fee?
That's an adult admission to all the events from noon on the 15th to noon on the 18th. That includes overnight camping for the festival, then free vending. If somebody wants to vend, they just need to let us know ahead of time. The festival site is at a place called Our Haven, and there's a link on the website so people can check out the festival location. It's a wonderful location. They have hot showers. They have things like that that sometimes aren't always available. But it's a great site. They do a lot of festivals there, and so that's basically, it includes everything that's going on. There's no charge for events at the festival. Everything that's going on at the festival is included in the admission.
And no food or anything like that is included, so people have to fend for their own shelter, camping type areas, and bring their own food and things like that, right?
Yes, it is. It is camping. We actually have a food vendor that will be there, that if people want to buy food from her, they can. Otherwise, they can bring coolers and stuff like that and bring their own food in.
Are there any restrictions on bottles or cans or anything, what can or cannot be brought onto the property?
No glass around the fire. Apparently, they just don't want glass around the fire because that's where people are dancing. So people who bring bottles into their own site, you know, if they brought something to drink in, and no firearms or anything like that on the grounds. So.
Okay. I was looking at the hosting location's website. Is this a clothing optional campground?
Yeah, actually it is, which is why the festival is 18 and over. It's adults only.
Okay.
So there will be no kids allowed at the festival.
Right.
There's an area outside of the festival grounds that actually belongs to our haven that if anybody do bring kids that they can camp at, but the kids will not be allowed into the festival ground.
Okay. If anyone has any questions, who should they email?
They can. Well, there's two different things. They can email admission@babylonrising.org for questions about festival admissions and pricing. If they want to be considered for a workshop or something, they can email organizer@babylonrising.org. But either one of those is going to get to one of us, and if it's the wrong person, we'll get it to the right person. So.
All right. Is there a maximum number of attendees?
No, we actually don't have a maximum number of attendees. The site could handle, I mean, if we have to add on our side to security and things like that, that's a problem I hope we have. The site actually can handle right around 500 people. So I guess, yeah, but the maximum would be 500 people, and I really hope that's a problem.
That would be great. Is there anything else you want to add?
About the festival or about
yes.
Why we're doing this?
I thought you said earlier why you were doing it, because you were sitting around.
I told you, you know, how it came about, but when we started talking about this, we realized this event's going to could conceivably raise a significant amount of money, and we'd actually like to make it an annual thing. We're already talking about what we might want to do next year.
Okay.
So we sat and discussed, and what we decided to do, since this is a pan-Salemic event, you know, it's open to anybody that wants to come and participate in the Philomic Festival. We are probably going to have a table, so if organizations that are there want to put brochures or anything out, they can. We're expecting everybody, you know, to play nice and have fun while they're there. But we decided to set up, you know how libraries and stuff will have, like, friends of the library. We decided to set this up as a benefit corporation in the state of Indiana. We're in the process of getting that approved, to be able to provide grants to Salemic not-for-profit organizations or charities.
Okay.
So the first order of business is to secure the future of the festival, make sure we have enough money to run the festival next year. And then we will set up a process where Salemic groups, they have to be recognized not-for-profits. That's state law, not ours. But they will be able to apply and say, hey, you know, we want to do this or we want to build that or whatever. We'll set up some grant guidelines, and that's still being developed, but we're setting up a foundation for people, for Salemic groups to apply for grants to help their groups out do different things.
Excellent.
Yeah, I'm really excited about being able to facilitate the Salemic community at large that way.
Now, is there an OTO body in the near area?
The nearest OTO body is Indianapolis, so yeah, they're about 2 hours away.
Okay.
So, yeah, they certainly could benefit. And a lot of the local OTO bodies here in the Midwest, Black Sun, Omaha, Onophrus and Indy, Starry Arch, those groups are all planning to participate and to be involved and to help with the security and gates and all that kind of stuff. So the people from the OTO are actually very active, and we've had some volunteers from other groups and from other Philomic, from across the Philomic community. I know that... Gerald contacted me and the Order of Flemish Knights.
Excellent.
Not sure what they're going to be able to do this year, but actually are very interested if we do something next year in participating. But at the very least, I think they're going to support us with coming to the festival and that type of thing. So we're trying really hard to reach out to Thelemites in general.
Wonderful.
Hold together the Flemish community as a big community. We have high hopes for it.
Well, this sounds great. I'm really excited about what you're doing, and should my schedule allow, I hope to come out and attend the festival.
We'd love to have you. You could. I think it'd be real, real fun for you to walk around the festival, maybe get a chance to interact with, you know, other Salemites too. Even not the speakers aside, I'm sure you've talked to most of them. I don't know if you've met Neema or not, but I'm sure you've talked to most of them. But I think even just talking to some of the festival attendees, we have a group that's coming. That's a tantra group. They're, that's
oh.
what they're, and they contacted, or, you know, they're kind of connected through our haven. They go out there, but they had just started incorporating Philemic ideas into their group, and so they get kind of excited that we were going to run this Philemic festival. They're called Robin Hood's Community Center is the name of the group, and so different groups even that are not blatantly Philemic groups are contacting us and saying, you know, we're interested in what you're doing and we'd like to participate. We have a chaos magician, Andre Vitimus, I believe is how he pronounces his name, is going to be doing a workshop on chaos magic. So we have, you know, a real wide range of speakers and topics going on, and we're actually hoping to add to it some more as we get closer. We've had some other speaker information come in, but those are the big speakers, and particularly Lon. Lon will keep Lon very, very busy while he's here.
Right, I'm sure. All right, well, I really appreciate you being on the show and telling people about this wonderful festival. Again, can you give the website?
Sure, it's www.BabylonRising, one word, BABALON, rising.org.
All right.
And thanks, John, for your support, and actually we hope to see you out there.
Well, that sounds good. If I can swing it with the schedule and everything, I certainly will be there.
Okay.
Well, thanks again. 93,
John. Bye.
Bye. We have on the phone with us John Sewell. Are you there, John?
I'm here.
93, welcome to the podcast.
93, thank you.
For those listening, John is the director and producer of The Rites of Luna, a rock opera. It's a rock opera interpretation of Aleister Crowley's The Rite of Luna, and it has just been released as a DVD and a CD. John, what was the inspiration for you to do a rock opera version of the Rites of Luna versus the Aleister Crowley version straight out of the book?
Well, what it comes down to is I've spent years working as a musician and working as a ceremonial magician on my own before I came to the OTO. But to take the story and sort of explain the way it unfolded, in 1999 and 2000, I became involved with the local OTO body, and when attending a camp out, I saw a production of The Rite of Luna. It actually... my friend Yuri, just a brilliant actor, played the part of Pan, and it was incredible and it was very moving. And it was produced by Golden Apple Camp, and they were doing the rites in regular succession at that time and invited me to do the Rite of Jupiter. Well, I was like, oh, okay, that would be great. And they explained that I would get to direct and be the god form. This was sort of their tradition. And the day that I was going to go meet with the people to start production on the Rite of Jupiter, you know, sort of the first cast meeting and stuff, I went to a matinee of Rent. And after sitting through this matinee, I was like, okay, I want to do this as a musical. So this was 2001. And we did Jupiter as a musical in 2001, and it was really good, but it was very rushed. We really wanted to get it out there because Golden Apple was ready to move on with their cycle. So I felt like we didn't really do it the justice it deserved, but I had really been moved by Luna when I'd seen it the first time, and so I thought, you know what, this is the one that I want to do. And instead of seeing, can we do it? I want to see how well we can do it. And so I took the original poetry, all the words are Crowley's, and sat down with my acoustic guitar and started composing music. And one of the first pieces I composed was Uncharmable Charmer, because it was just this glorious poem. And Melissa Holm, who plays Cancer, played the flute on that.
Well, we have Uncharmable Charmer, so let me play a segment of that for the listeners.
Charmable charmer of Bacchus and Mars, in the sounding and rebounding abyss of the stars. O virgin Anna, thine arrows unsling, in the brilliant resilient first rays of the
After we'd started writing the music, and again, you can hear that it came out very, very nice, we had gone through and sort of cast all the roles as we were recording the CD, so that way we could have the people who were on the CD performing in the show. And at the
so you did
time,
the CD before you did the actual show itself? So the CD is not just a soundtrack of the DVD, it's actually a studio-produced version of the music.
That is correct. And actually all recorded in my home and engineered by myself. I've started doing recording and engineering years ago in my home and did a couple albums for the band that I was in, and eventually found that this was more my passion. That in Seattle, there's about 4,000 bands, and there's three or four people writing musical theater, so it's a lot easier to kind of get your foot in the door. It's something I felt passionate about. I loved doing Jupiter so much that I knew that this was something I was really going to enjoy, and I have to say it was some of the finest moments of my life, standing there on that stage. It was incredible. I played Pan. In fact, if you come right down to it, the reason that I did this is because I wanted to play Pan.
Right. Well, that's understandable. Now, the DVD version, where was that recorded?
The DVD was shot at the Richard Hugo House on Capitol Hill, and it's a black box theater, really great sound system, really great lighting, and it was shot. We first shot one of the dress rehearsals with the Art Institute, and that's actually the core reason as to why we are donating the proceeds of the sale of DVD to Grand Lodge.
Okay.
Is that the Art Institute said, well, we can do it for free for you, but you have to be a nonprofit. And I said, well, I don't have a nonprofit number, but I contacted Grand Lodge and made arrangements to do it through Grand Lodge.
Is the performance through an OTO body, or is it through working with U.S. Grand Lodge?
Well, strangely, I don't know what it falls under. It's sort of its own autonomous thing. It's not. I don't have any Grand Lodge oversight in what I'm doing. They did not sanction it. They didn't come out and say, this is what the Grand Lodge wants. It was more, I did this project, and they helped me out, and as a result, they get the intellectual property.
Okay.
So it's more of a gift from me to them.
Okay.
But it's not under a local body, because the local body, my friend Yuri, who I mentioned before, who played Pan in that first Rite of Luna that I saw, has been producing the rights of Eleusis or Horizon Oasis here locally, and I didn't want to compete with him. I didn't want to draw necessarily from the same talent pool. He has a specific role that he fulfills in the community, and he and I are very close, and so I wanted to make sure that I wasn't getting in there and messing with what he had going on.
Right. We also have a segment of the song called The Interpreter. Can you give a brief introduction to that?
Oh, I would be happy to. The Interpreter is one of my favorite pieces in that it's one of the places in the Rite where we didn't alter Crowley's text, but we added to it. We added other vocal parts. You see, when we were developing the music itself, part of what we were trying to do is take the ideas that Crowley had put on the page there and try to give more humanity to the characters and develop attitudes and ideas, and they're all based on the archetypes. Cancer is this very strong outward appearance with the shell, and on the inside she's very frightened. And we brought this all out in their characters. So the Interpreter, while it's Crowley's original text for the poem The Interpreter, actually has more lines that we added with the other characters singing over the top of it with, you know, different answering voices to some of the things that Pan is saying that Crowley wrote.
All right, well, here it is.
Oh, thanks.
God was my sire, by the Lord of the flame and the lightning, the king of the spirits of fire. By the Lord of the waves and the waters, the king of the hosts of the sea, the fairest of all of whose daughters was mother to me.
No
man by the Lord of the waves and the breezes, the king of the spirits of the
I'm
Well, if people want to get a copy of the CD or DVD, how can they get in touch with you?
Well, the way that we set up the DVD reproduction, I didn't want to pay basically up front to produce a whole slew of DVDs, so we found a online on-demand publishing company that was willing to take on the project, and basically you can go to our website at www.rightofluna.com, and you go to the merchandise page, and right there you can purchase a copy of the DVD or a copy of the soundtrack, and as you purchase the copy, it will take you to the website where you ordered it from the on-demand publishing, and they will produce it and ship it for me, so that basically I pay no overhead.
That's the same thing for the CD.
That's the same for the CD.
Excellent.
So it's a really nice system. It saves a lot of trouble and a lot of trips to the post office.
Well, I have actually ordered a copy and own one, and I did not know it was on-demand production. It looked like a normal production CD or DVD to me. So this is news to me. So for anybody ordering it, it will not look like it was an on-demand. I know a lot of early on-demand publishing books and so forth, you could kind of tell, but this definitely looks like a normal produced DVD.
Well, we were really, really careful to do a lot of really nice branding and artwork with it. We tried to make the packaging really appealing. We wanted people to have something that they could, you know, hold. And basically what we were going for was something that when you looked at it, it wasn't, wow, this is a cool Thelemic thing. It was, wow, this is really an amazing production without the proviso of it's being done by OTO people, but it's just good because it's good. It stands up on its own.
Mm. And are you working on any further projects?
Right now we're working on The Rite of Venus.
The Rite of Venus.
I know that we're doing them out of order, and that's completely unorthodox, but so are we. So we decided that the next one we wanted to do was Venus, mainly because we had some really great ideas for the music, and because we felt that it would be nice to sort of cut our teeth on the bottom of the tree, and then we did Luna, we're going to do Venus and Mercury, and then move up to Saturn, and we're going to complete all seven of them, and then you can order the set of all seven DVDs in the collector's edition. But that's a few years in the future. Venus is coming along beautifully, though. It's whereas Luna was a lot of flute work and a lot of classical guitar, Venus is going to be sort of a techno goth belly dance thing. It's going to be very cool.
Okay, that sounds kind of interesting.
Well, we're casting the belly dancers, and we've really got some neat ideas for this. And it's most likely going to be opening summer 2007.
Summer 2007. Well, that's great. Again, what was the website?
That's www.rightofluna.com.
Great. Well, John, I really appreciate you being on the show, and I really appreciate you taking the time and actually producing such a great production as The Rite of Luna, and uniquely as a rock opera. That was actually something that caught my eye, so I hope listeners will go out and check it out.
I appreciate it. There's video and sound samples available on the website if people want to check it out, and I really, really appreciate your taking the time to talk to me today.
All right, great. Well, thank you. 93. Jerry, welcome back to the podcast, 93.
Oh, thank you. 93. Oh, nice to be here.
Now, a number of weeks ago, we talked about your book, Aleister Crowley and the Ouija Board, but you also have two other books, or I guess one book in two parts, a biography of Grady Lewis McMurtry.
That's correct. It actually got too large for one book. Each volume's over 200 pages.
And each of those are a volume in your ongoing Red Flame series?
That's correct. The first volume deals predominantly with just Grady from his birth up to 1962,
uh-huh.
or Germer's death. And the second volume deals with after Germer's death up to Grady's death.
So one of the things that you were noting to me is that with all of the many biographies that have come out, including W.T. Smith, Bennett, Jane Wolfe, and everybody else, all of those are direct students of Crowley, and there has never been any student of the students of Crowley, or I guess the generations around the time of the regeneration of the OTO.
Yeah, I think the uniqueness about so many of the biographies is that so many of those individuals, although they are pertinent to Thelemic history, they all died in the 50s. So it doesn't give us a sense of what happened in the late 50s with Carl Germer and the OTO. That was a catastrophic period. And what happened in the 60s and the 70s to get Grady out of hiding to have the OTO reemerge. So all the other biographies are brilliant in a lot of ways, but they fall short of helping modern OTO people understand their history.
Now, you said the first volume ends with the death of Germer.
That's correct.
So is the first volume very, I guess it has both a lot of material about Grady as well as Germer?
Well, it has a lot about Germer in there, but it deals a lot with Grady's childhood. A lot about how he first got involved with Agape Lodge. And it talks a lot about the behind-the-scenes rituals, what occurred there, how Grady got hooked up in World War II in the Army, and how he ended up in England to meet Crowley. So there's a lot of Crowley there, and it deals with a lot of the 1950s, which is that elusive period in OTO history.
What kind of sources did you have to work with on this?
Well, I have one of the largest archives of Grady material. In fact, there are hundreds and hundreds of letters that I have that even the OTO archives doesn't have. So I have a lot of personal Grady stuff.
And this is between Grady and a number of individuals?
Yeah, a lot of people don't understand that Grady actually corresponded hundreds of letters back and forth with people like Jane Wolfe, Jack Parsons, Leffingwell, the Burlingames. He has a massive collection of letters that he's done with very famous people. Germer's files between Grady and him are almost two huge folder fills, and same with Crowley.
And
there's a lot of info in those early years.
And you are also a student directly of Grady's.
That's correct. I had joined, in fact, when Phyllis was taking on some of her early AA initiates, I was one of the early AA initiates with Grady.
Now, what other kind of materials about the OTO are in the second volume?
Well, the second volume is tough because we hear snippets of information by a lot of the modern historians about how Grady reactivated the OTO. And unfortunately, most of the snippets are coming from a lot of European sources who are trying to sit back and have their own private agenda on how they want to more or less knock Grady all the time, but not being the true head of the OTO. And so what I've tried to do is I've tried to explain how Grady took over, or actually ended up reactivating the OTO.
And can you give an idea of what kind of critiques the Europeans are saying that you demonstrate in the book are not valid?
Well, most of the very common sense one is the fact they don't believe Grady, was OHO. They don't believe that he had the right to be OHO. And so many of them like to place Metzger, the Swiss OTO, as being the true OTO, which in truth is ludicrous, totally ludicrous. In some ways, when you have to understand politics in relationship to the period and not today, it's easy for us to look at the OTO today historically and trying to put our perspectives and our rules and regulations back in the past. But we can't do that. We have to study Grady's life in relationship to itself. And when Crowley died, for instance, there were only three Grand Lodge officers in the world. That was all. And the three officers was Grady McMurtry and Carl Germer.
And the third one?
There wasn't any.
I thought you said there were three.
Three, yeah. It was actually Crowley, Germer, and Grady.
Okay.
And there was no Grand Secretary. There was the Grand Treasurer and a Sovereign Grand Inspector General. That was it.
Mm-hmm.
And when Crowley plainly said Germer was the next head of the OTO. But the difference is, the problem is that Crowley wanted an election, and that's what he specified, that the OTO members in the ninth degrees would get together and elect Germer, even though they all knew Germer was going to be it. But Germer never, ever, ever actually fulfilled that obligation. So what occurred is Germer himself, from about 47 all the way up to the mid-50s, was like flopping like a fish out of water. I am the head of the OTO. I'm not the head of the OTO. I'm the head of the OTO. I'm not the head of the OTO. And the same thing occurred with Grady. When Germer died, Grady was the only head of the OTO still alive. So Grady also didn't necessarily, you know, take the reins and run with it properly. And he wouldn't do that, unfortunately, until the late 60s. But when you read Grady's letters of the period, he plainly thinks that the OTO is, for all practical purposes, almost dead by the time Germer dies itself.
Everybody has read much of the history about the cases with Germer and Moda.
Right.
All of the disputes back and forth on who's the head and all of that. What relationship or what do you cover in your book about that?
About Germer and Moda?
Or just the whole dispute about the head of the OTO leadership with Germer and Moda and then Grady taking over?
Well, there was no dispute with the OTO and Moda, because Moda was just AA.
Well, he did think he was OTO, and that was why the court case took
place. Go into that, but that doesn't occur till the late 60s. But you see, the problem is when they start realizing that Germer is dead, Phyllis comes out of hiding with Grady. And Phyllis and Grady have, let's say, difficulties, and Phyllis starts corresponding with Moda. Mm-hmm. And the problem that happens is Sasha Germer tells Phyllis, it's like a comedy of errors. Sasha tells Phyllis that she read her husband's will, and the will states unequivocally that Moda is the head of the OTO. That is the heir. So Phyllis takes it upon herself to contact Moda and tell him this. Well, in the meantime now, the will is found, because Sasha couldn't find the will originally. And once the actual will is found, it's found that Moda is not mentioned anywhere in the will. So where Sasha came up with this information is anyone's guess. But when Moda was told this, he starts thinking it's a conspiracy. Obviously, they're rewriting the will. Obviously, the will is being buried. That points to him being head of the OTO. And it's just ludicrous. You know, so I do go in depth into that particular period.
What other topics do you go into the beginning of the U.S., the OTO worldwide, or the U.S. OTO, or how did Grady see what he was reconstituting? Did he see it as the English-speaking branch and that there was still the Swiss branch like there is today, or was he thinking that there was no OTO existing at all and he was reconstituting it from nothing?
He thought he was more or less reconstituting it from nothing. The Swiss OTO virtually are not even in question. I have tons of correspondence and letters that go back virtually 10 years ago where they were virtually non-existent. And now that they're re-emerging, they're creating a great history and legacy about themselves. But you have to remember that Germer didn't like the Swiss OTO. I mean, Germer, toward the end of his life, hated Metzger as much as he hated Moda. So the idea that they would take over and become head of the OTO is a ludicrous concept.
But they still have a pre-Crowley type of OTO structure going, using a lot of the Royce material.
Well, that in itself. But it doesn't make it the legitimate OTO through Royce to Crowley to Germer to Grady. If they have their own little OTO clique, it's not the OTO. And that's the problem. And the problem that I've always had with some of the Europeans is not that they may or may not have justification. That we should leave that to the gods. If they're really true, they'll survive, and that's the gods' point of view. But the idea that their justification comes by attacking the American OTO to knock Hymenius Beta, or the OTO, off a throne, is childish.
Where else do you want
this? There's a lot of stuff in Grady's bio, from the Solar Lodge to how Grady came back to California, why he came back, all the politics that were occurring in the 70s, and are all there. So it's a very unique volume, actually, to see all the different gossip and so forth.
And it ends in the mid-80s with Grady's death?
That's true. And one of the other important things to understand about Grady's bio is that it's no secret that his ex-wife, Phyllis, him and her, they had difficulties together. That's no secret. In fact, Phyllis was very venomous against Grady. And when I finished the biography, every single chapter was sent to her to review, because I felt that if anyone knew Grady, it would be her. And she actually loved the bio. She said I was very fair. I trashed Grady where Grady deserved to be trashed, and I was fair where, you know, I should have been fair.
So you had actually completed this before Phyllis died?
Yes, oh, 100%, definitely. So she read the entire book from A to Z. And there's a few points she didn't agree with, naturally, but she really liked the volume. And we corresponded only by writing, so everything was put into writing. So when she would offer me feedback, it all came in writing and so forth. But it was pretty good. It was pretty neat to have.
So have you gotten any feedback about the biography so far?
Yeah, I'm getting great feedback. Phenomenal. But I also let other people read the book, from Bill Heidrich on down.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they read all the different pieces about themselves. And they've all offered great advice and great insights into a period that is very hard to understand. So, you know, I really hope that people will enjoy it and, you know, get a behind-the-scenes picture of how we were reestablishing the OTO back then.
Now, you've published this in the 6x9 perfect bound format, correct?
That's correct.
And how many have you printed of each volume?
Yeah, I don't remember. I really don't. There was quite a few.
Okay. And if people wanted to get a hold of them, who can they get them through?
Well, there's quite a few stores that do carry them. They can either order them online on our Red Flame website, or Weiser's. Weiser's carries them and will gladly distribute them.
Right. And the reason I ask about the number is because I remember in the beginning, a lot of the Red Flames were issued at a limited set of 156.
Yeah, that was because of the method of binding, and the method of actually printing them was harder to do. But with the modern-day printing and so forth, we've been able to actually up the quantity.
Okay, great.
Yeah. Now, the Grady's book, I think, will really impress people an awful lot. I think there's a lot of good meat in there. You know, it's not the definitive study, but at the same time, it's the first.
So do you think this will be the first biography of kind of the reconstituting of the OTO, and that there will be more history books written about that period?
Well, I hope so. We're working on Phyllis McMurtry's bio right now.
Excellent. And that will come out as another Red
Flame? Red Flame, yeah.
Fantastic.
So we hope to continue with a lot of the history and so forth, because that's what the OTO people need. They need a good balance and stuff of what actually happened. And it's very hard to write about. Extremely hard, but it's a labor of love.
Yes, actually, most of the things that are serving the Thelemic community right now are more about promulgating Thelema and keeping the movement alive than actual making money from it.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Red Flame has never made money. We make enough money to print the next issue.
Right.
But that's fine by us.
No, it has been the exact same thing for me and all the books of Luxor Press. I've never made a single penny on it. All of the money and sales go directly back into the press for covering all the costs, shipping and everything.
That should be the way it is, though. You know, I'm not really out to make a living off it.
Well, when the Phyllis biography comes out, please let us know. We would love to have you back on the show and
That mean probably won't be for at least another year or so.
Okay, so it's probably going to be in first part of 2007.
Gee, I won't put a date down onto it. Actually, Marlene is actually working on that, not myself.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I'm actually working on a book on the history of the Holy Guardian Angel right now.
Oh, that's fascinating.
And I hope to have that done, hopefully by the end of the year.
Well, great. And that, too, will be a Red Flame issue?
Of course. Of course.
Well, great. All right. Well, then we look forward to talking to you at the end of the year.
Okay. Very good.
Thanks for being on the show. 93.
Oh, 93. Bye-bye.
So this brings us to the end of another podcast. Thank you all very much for listening, especially since this is an extra long show. By the time you're listening to me speak now, it's already been an hour and 40 minutes, so I'll wrap this up quickly. Again, I want to remind everybody that Thelema Coast to Coast is broadcast on the Circle of Souls Pagan Radio Network at www.circleofsouls.net, and that is at every Wednesday night at 8 p.m. Eastern Time. Also, I did want to mention that after the interview with John about the Rite of Luna DVD, he sent me a follow-up email, something he wanted me to add. He said, "I would like to add a postscript to my interview. I realize that I gave an incomplete answer to an important question you asked me when you inquired why I had not done this under the auspices of a local body. I mentioned not wanting to cause confusion with my friend Yuri's productions of the rites under Horizon Oasis, but I neglected to mention the biggest reason. I was completely uncertain whether this production would make any money. In fact, we did not show a profit, and it would have been unfair to ask the local body to take a financial loss on this project. On the other hand, our production of Luna was seen by more than 250 people, some of whom have since expressed an interest in Thelema and the OTO. I don't recall if I mentioned in my interview that we received promotional support from both Horizon Oasis and Vortex Camp for the Seattle production, and of course Sekhet Mot Lodge for the show in Portland. These bodies were thanked profusely in the programs for the respective shows, but I want to make sure that my interview doesn't sound like we received no support from the local bodies on this project." So, again, thanks to the local bodies who assisted on the Rite of Luna project. And lastly, again, the closing song is Crucified Serpent, and that is from the group Asmodeus X. And as I said before, the CD is a promotion from Latex Records. So those interested in getting a copy should go to latexrecords.com. And if you're interested in winning it, send an email to podcast@thelemacoasttocoast with your address, and I will choose one random entry. So that's it for this show. I hope you enjoyed it, even though it was a long one. And I hope you stick around for the next one. Love is the law. Love under will.